Hello. Thank you for coming. Thanks, James, for convening this. I enjoyed your presentation, and Giuseppe, thank you, and Ileana as well. This is something in the way of notes about some of the less known films of Paul Schrader. The life and work of Paul Schrader offer a case in which the artist's statements give the lie to a search for the presence of biography in his films. In the audiovisual image, to paraphrase Bresson, who Schrader quotes in a review, it's necessity rather than beauty that guides the composition of shots in Schrader's films. Necessity in an art form might be defined as the use of the medium to counteract its own sensuality. So in the tension between the capacity to give pleasure to the eyes and ears and the gesture beyond the world of the senses, the image, at least the way Schrader sees it, transcends itself. The deliberate exploitation of this tension is the style that the title of his book, Transcendental Style in Film, refers. He's written and said a great deal about his life and times, and this presents a certain temptation to view the films in light of biographical events. I'd like to resist that temptation a little bit. Schrader was born and grew up in a middle-class family in Grand Rapids, Michigan, within an insular and repressive Dutch Protestant congregation. Along with the intensive Bible study and compulsory church-going that characterized his childhood and youth, a period of rebellion in early adulthood against a society he saw as racist and imperialist is the most conspicuous biographical aspect of this director. His earliest career aspiration was to become a minister, then an attorney, then a journalist. So a certain evangelism and a need to serve his community extends into the theory and criticism he produced before going on to write and direct films. But the most significant biographical fact, as he's said and written many, many times, is the Calvinist theology with which his aesthetic and his themes are imbued. The most important part of that worldview is the doctrine of predestination, as everybody knows. The idea not that character is fate, as Heraclitus says, but that there is the eternal decree of God by which he has determined in himself what would have to become of every individual of mankind. You could almost say plot is the will of God in a Schrader film, and the characters want to believe they are making their own decisions. You could say the same about genre and the filmmaker himself. This summer, I attended a 7 o'clock Saturday screening of his new film, The Master Gardener. And 2 weeks later, the cinema where I'd sat by myself in an almost vacant theater, the Albany Twin, to see it, shut down after 80 years of continuous operation. In the film, Joel Edgerton plays a reformed neo-Nazi. And as with others of Schrader's films, the familiar conventions of the genre, in this case, the tattooed white musculature as a fetish object, the midpoint of a journey toward redemption, jeopardized by a righteous but illegal act, the choice of sexual partner that aligns the protagonist with some people and against others, take shape on screen as gestures that signal to the audience ways in which the picture departs from the genre and uses it to tell a different story and refines it in a deliberate and conscious manner. So the film alludes to American history. X, Romper Stomper, Skin, Imperium, Green Room, The Believer in the Fade. This is England, Welcome to Laith, Apt Pupil, and the episode of The Twilight Zone entitled He's Alive. The film assumes the viewer has seen these movies and knows what to expect, and it endeavors to present variations. The tradition of violence haunts Affliction as it does The Master Gardener. And here the this is in the background. This is the he's done away with his dad in this film, and he's burnt the barn where his dad is. That's Nick Nolte. It has an extremely grim plot trajectory. And we'll see later in There Are No Saints, there is also this biblical theme of the sins of the father being visited upon the son from the opposite perspective. The later film, The Master Gardener, that is, clings to an opposed tradition of the rejection of violence, the embrace of other means and other ends. Many of Schrader's films dramatize this choice. In The Card Counter, in The Card Counter, an itinerant gambler, William Tell, is indoctrinated into the tradition of male violence at the hands of his commanding officer in Abu Ghraib, where he takes part in the notorious abuse of the prisoners, and the film concludes with a bone-crunching reenactment of this torture off-screen at the major's house. Tell goes back to military prison. His soul is cleansed. In There Are No Saints, which Schrader wrote but did not direct, the main character, whose name is Neto Niente, which is a very satisfying character name, I think. It's played by José María Yaspic, a.k.a. the Jesuit, so-called after the torturers of the Spanish Inquisition, gets out of prison when the key witness in his case changes his testimony, a very conspicuous genre feature of this kind of film. We're in a neo-noir upgrade of Cormac McCarthy territory, complete with some very satisfying ultra-violence. Neon rain pelts the blood-soaked asphalt of a Texas city where the sins of the father are visited upon the son. Neto comes under suspicion when his ex-wife is murdered and her boyfriend kidnaps his son, Julio. The backdrop in this shot, very literally, in an almost didactic, sort of annoying way, is firearms, xenophobia, and racism in contemporary USA. Niente pursues Vincent, a real estate developer, now gunrunner, into Mexico, and plies his trade until Vincent reveals that he gave little Julio to Señor Sanz to pay off a debt. Niente is knocked out and comes to in a car driving up the coast. He dispatches his captors and drives to their destination, a compound deep in the forest. He is captured and thrown in a dungeon. Señor Sanz is an aficionado of torture and reveals he's the father of a boy Niente murdered. In a grim orgy of bludgeoning, stabbing, and blasting, the Jesuit slaughters the guards as Señor Sanz lowers Julio headfirst into a well where he drowns. In the concluding scenes, the Jesuit prays to his son and avenges him. The historical circumstance provides a backdrop for the drama in many of these films. This is, of course, Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark. The protagonists are most often working people faced with an impossible choice. Schrader wrote and directed a prequel to The Exorcist called Dominion, and it would be a stretch to say that this is a good movie. However, it has some features that a lot of the films share. The Dutch priest of Dominion is compelled to choose 10 of his flock to die at the Nazis' hands in order to save the town. He's another haunted white man. And as we'll see with Adam Resurrected, the architecture frames the drama. The priest becomes an archaeologist, and the work makes for a darker, bleaker version of Raiders of the Lost Ark when a Byzantine temple is unearthed, which happens to be where Satan lives. It's a little bit corny, and the special effects, they attempt a kind of Hellraiser gore and eeriness, and they don't quite get there, but it's definitely, I think it's definitely worth seeing. Interlarded with flashbacks to a Weimar Berlin cabaret as the Nazis take power, the 2008 film Adam Resurrected depicts the return of Adam Stein, played by Jeff Goldblum, to an experimental psychiatric clinic in the Negev for survivors of the death camps, run by head physician Dr. Nathan, played by Derek Jacobi. The angles and tracking shots emphasize the architecture and its enforcement of power dynamics. In the Stellring camp, Adam became the private prisoner of the commandant, played by Willem Dafoe, but he has to behave like a dog wearing a collar and a leash, crawling on his hands and knees. "Before you cure me," Adam says to the staff of the Institute, "you'll all go crazy yourselves." Other familiar tropes. Adam is made like Adrian Brody's character in The Pianist to play music he's compelled, forced. Here are some of the other locations. Very often in Schrader's films, there's a building or a piece of architecture that centers the action in a place. It's a kind of focus of the energy of the film. This is from First Reformed. This again is the Master Gardener. And this is the hotel in, I think it's Miami Beach, from a film called Forever Mine. I want to talk about a particular scene in this film for a moment. The film concerns a love story. It's a forbidden love story between two people who are separated by race and class, aspiration, circumstance, and they still manage to be together at the end at great cost to both of them. Ella is the female lead, and she volunteers at a senior center where one day she is shown reading a book to her charges. And the book is Madame Bovary. And the passage is the point in the story when Emma is reminiscing about the ball. She's been to the ball, and she's noticing that with every passing day, her precious memory becomes more and more remote until she can no longer recall specific details, and it's almost as if it never happened at all. And it's very heartbreaking to Emma Bovary, and heartbreaking and also not to us, because of course it's Flaubert's intent is in part satirical. This is not something for Flaubert that is worth aspiring to, so we see two things at once. It's peculiar to watch Emma reading the passage from Flaubert to the old women in the library. Her audience is moved by the words, but not for the same reason that Ella is. For them, it's possible to overlook the ambivalence of Emma's bourgeois longing for glamour and to focus instead on the emotion of her backward glance at the ball, which is, of course, the event that occasions Emma's reckless scheme and ultimately her suicide. For these women listening, it's too late for the parlor tragedy to touch them. They have known their share of Emma's. and can luxuriate in the character's passion for its own sake. As she reads the scene aloud, Ella identifies with Emma, and the similarity of their names is no accident. Her eyes moisten with the author's description of a cherished moment that recedes into the past until its features grow too vague to inspire an emotion, and it too becomes a memory. Unlike Emma, Ella loves a poor man. And so Schrader's comparison between them isn't about love as sexual passion plus class mobility. It's closer to courtly love in its origins in the medieval South of France, contrary to class loyalty and social norms. But Ella, too, ignores or does not notice the satire in Flaubert's character study, inspired by a newspaper story of a fictional woman who lent her name to the phenomenon of Bovarism, the belief that one's delusions are real. She reads as if the words were the voice of her heart. The Real Housewives franchise will launch in 2006, 7 years after the release of the film, eventually comprising 11 series that evince a mass interest in the depiction of women's lives at the nexus of race, class, sex, and gender in the United States. Yet Ella lives in a pre-reality television society in which it's still possible to believe that the forms of fantasy don't come cheap, but confine themselves to remote locales, secret encounters, a meeting on a beach at a resort hotel. Or, in what's certainly a point of reference for Forevermine, this is the beach at in Miami. What is certainly a reference for the film Forevermine, the Grand Hotel des Bains in Venice, depicted in Death in Venice, adapted by Visconti from the Thomas Mann novella, another story of forbidden love. Going through Schrader's filmography, one film at a time, I become aware of a fastidious quality. The director eschews transcendent content in his pursuit of a style. A purposeful absence of charm is in play. This counterimage of charisma comes from the non-heroic nature of the characters in a Schrader film. His people tend not to be good with flaws. Instead, they're evil in sufficient measure to prevent the audience from projecting onto them an innocent fantasy self, as contemporary American mainstream cinema invites viewers to do. In its place, a certain distance interposes itself in the cinematic image. It's an ethical distance. Metaphysical concerns acquire a palpable presence in the screen image. The emotional timbre of his films has to do with the limit that's always imposed whenever high culture tips the balance against pop. The emotion of American blockbuster movies is the feeling we experience in the presence of the sublime. But the artwork that intends other sorts of effects will depart from the imagery and concepts that make up these conventions. Against the backdrop of big box office fares, such films seem like chamber dramas or anachronistic period pieces. They're pretentious films whose emotional register departs from a norm made up of cosmic wonder plus sex and or murder under the aegis of nationalism. A film that does this without simply putting a novel or a play on screen makes a contribution to the art.